Welcome to Don't Give Up Your Daydream, Transitions in a Transitioning World. Hello, I'm your guest, your host, John Knuckle. I'm a private equity advisor slash author slash radio host. Welcome, my fellow creative professionals, to Don't Give Up Your Daydream, where creativity and drive meet experience and guidance. Our goal is to introduce you to guests who have gone through major transitions in their lives or careers and have landed in a better place. All of them have kept their creativity alive, and it has been vital to their success. It is a thrill to have Matt Long as my guest. Matt is a best-selling author and founder and driving force behind the I Will Foundation. Matt has overcome a devastating injury and personal hardship to become one of New York's and the world's most inspirational figures. I can say that after reading The Long Run, his book, and learning a little about Matt and his foundation, I am a better person for having known him. I'm sure you will feel the same. We'll be right back with Matt after these brief commercial messages.
Message brought to you by FEMA. Fire is everyone's fight. We all have a role to play in making sure fires don't start. That's why the USFA invites you to join Fire is Everyone's Fight to protect you and your family from the dangers of fire. A home fire is your most dangerous fire threat. Home fires kill and injure 16,000 Americans annually, and the leading cause of these fires is from cooking. So when you cook, avoid wearing loose clothing. Keep anything that can catch fire away from cooking surfaces. Turn pot handles in, and around cooking areas maintain a 3-foot kid-free zone. Smoke alarms can make the difference between life and death. Install them inside and outside sleeping areas and on all levels of your home. Alarms with long life batteries are best. Change others every year. Test alarms monthly and replace smoke alarms that are more than 10 years old. Every second counts, so prepare and practice a home fire drill with your family. Learn more at www.usfa.fema.gov.
Hi, you're listening to Don't Give Up Your Daydream. I'm your host, John Knuckle, and we are privileged to have Mr. Matt Long with us today. How are you, Matt?
Very good, John. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. Now, before we get too much into the interview, I saw on Facebook you were riding your bike in Spain recently, last month.
Good old Facebook.
I saw the video of the wind blowing somebody over. What was that about? were you in that?
No, I think that was just a link I shared or an old memory that made it popped up. Facebook is making it easy for you to see things that happened 5-6 years ago.
But you're doing,
but I have
you're
ridden
still
my
actively,
bike in Spain.
Yeah, okay. But you are still actively participating in a lot of these, especially biking events, is that right?
Yes, I am. Of course, last season I finished with the Grand Fondue, 100-mile bike race.
Wow.
And I actively race in a local series here in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I know, you're known for your book, The Long Run, which I just finished a couple of weeks ago. I have to tell you, it blew me away. And you should know I've run about 12 miles since I finished reading it last week. So I got back off the couch. It was great.
There you go. There you go. Love it.
Yeah. But you were a pretty active athlete. Before the subject of your book, or I guess what made you known to most people. Can you tell us a little about that, about your training and everything before your accident?
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically, John, I've been an athlete my entire life. I mean, just growing up in the streets of Brooklyn, playing basketball and running around different things. I was a walk-on, so can't say I played too much at Iona College, and we're dancing this March Madness season, so I'm pretty happy about that.
Yeah, that's very cool.
You know, and after college, I played quite a bit of ball with the fire department when I became a New York City fireman. Traveled around. That was enabled me to travel the country. But when I got too old to play competitively, I took to endurance sports. You know, where basically you're competing with yourself and a clock. I became a marathon runner. I became a triathlete and set a goal to become an Ironman. And luckily, right around the age of 38, I qualified for my first Boston Marathon and finished my first Ironman in just about 11 hours.
Yeah, I know. I mean, from the book, it's great. You do talk a little about, like, your love for running, how it's something that just grabbed you and you could just go, how it, I guess it relaxes you and lets you get rid of the stress of the day.
Yeah, that was always my one of the things that fueled my running. Look, when you get good at something, you tend to embrace it a little more. So when running became less of a struggle for me, because when I did start getting into these sports, I was a little heavier, you know, and labored to get around Central Park, which is a six-mile loop. But when I got the fitter I got, the better I got at running, I started taking more from it than just, hey, I can go out and run fast. You know, if I had a tough day at the firehouse or a tough day personally or whatever, it's, hey, there's nothing easier than, you know, lacing up your sneakers and going for a run. You know,
the
first 30 minutes of my run would be me kind of thinking about, hey, you know, what's really bothering me today and how important is it? The second 30 minutes of the run, or, you know, it's all gone. It's over. And I realized
it's peaceful,
It wasn't that important.
See, well, I'm a little different. I started, got back into running, like I said, after I read your book. And my first 100 yards is, remember the old Bugs Bunny cartoon where he's pitching the baseball and going, and his body's twisting and contorting? That's how I feel the first 10 yards or so, and then I get into a pace. Now, most of New York, obviously, a lot of people know, you know, about your accident and what happened. But, you know, we have a lot of people on the West Coast, and could you share a little bit about the story of your accident and how it came about?
Sure. Well, December of 2005, the New York City Transit Authority goes on strike. I was just finishing up a detail that I took from my firehouse in Spanish Harlem to work at the Fire Academy training the probies, which are our cadets or new recruits. And I was their, one of their PT instructors. So the Transit Authority goes on strike, and right around Christmas time, so it was like the 20th, I believe, the first day of the strike, it was a very cold winter, and people had to make provisions to get in and out of the city because the mayor had put restrictions surrounding the city for traffic.
It was
a tough time in the city. The strike really shut it down. So I rode my bike. You know, I decided, okay, my last day at the academy before Christmas, I was taking a week off vacation, and I decided to ride my bike. And like most days in the academy, I was working with fitness-minded guys, and we would meet a half hour to 45 minutes before work and go for a run or go for a swim. Or do some kind of physical activity ourselves. So I was trying to push to get to work by 6 a.m. And I got about four blocks from where I lived on East 48th Street. And a private bus, you know, just made a illegal turn all the way from the left side of the avenue and just took me out.
Wow.
You know, so it's a 40,000-pound bus we're talking about. And for whatever reason, when I talked to investigators about the scene, for whatever reason, I didn't bounce off the bus. I went back under the bus.
Yeah.
So that was part of my what made the ordeal more serious.
Now, you were in top physical shape at the time that this happened. That probably helped you a lot to overcome this.
100%. I mean, look, I can go back and back, and I can line up the people I'm supposed to thank for my survival. And, you know, I always credited God, and you know, I still do. My faith played a huge role in it. But I credited the doctors as well. And when I said to the doctors, thank you for saving my life, they basically said, we didn't save your life, you did. And I was kind of like, I didn't understand it at first, but they just said, listen, the average person couldn't have handled that amount of insult. That's what they called it. The average person couldn't have handled that amount of insult to your body, to their bodies. Your endurance activity level helped save your life.
Yeah, I know. They said, I think at one point you said someone, they gave you like a 5% chance of surviving.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a funny twist when I talk about my stories that they actually went out to tell my parents I had a 1% chance to live. And when the doctor went out and told my mom, you know, this is as bad as it gets, he's got a 1% chance to live. My mother turned around and said, he needs to make it, Doc. He's running the Boston Marathon in April, and he worked really hard for it.
Wow.
and that's
so she didn't believe in the 1%, did she?
Nope, she didn't give up hope at one bit. Yeah. And at that moment, the doctor realized, he's like, he qualified for the Boston Marathon, and he was a marathon runner himself. He said, he says, wow, now I know what I'm dealing with here. He goes, maybe he's got 5% chance.
Wow. Now, your book, The Long Run, I mean, there are so many things in the book that are so... I mean, just so important. I mean, the family unit you're from, the dynamic of the relationship with your brother and your parents, I'm telling you, it's more than just a story of you know, surviving an accident and coming back. I mean, this really is a lot of it's about family and the closeness you have with your family and how that helped you also.
100%. You know, I always thought that when the book came out in 2009 or 2000, I think it was 2010, 2010 the book came out, that the title was a little misleading because runners, like hardcore runners, would think, oh, this is great, I'm going to get this book, it's about running. And it's not. You know, it's really not about, it's about a guy who was full of life, who had, you know, always lived to the fullest, always was jumping at a chance to do something to push himself, and then had it all taken away. And then, you know, where I could come across in the book as, you know, I like to use the word cocky, I guess. You know, I come across in the book as a little cocky. But, hey, what kid from Brooklyn isn't?
That's right.
And
it's confident, not cocky.
Yeah, and I gratefully talk about that in my book, how me and my friend Matt Del Negro talked about the C, the confidence.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what you look like or how you dress or whatever. Yeah. If you walk into a room with confidence, people are going to look and wonder what's going on. So I always had that exuberant confidence that to some people came off negative, some people fed off it. But even though I came across that way, I realized that I didn't do this by myself. You know, it was my eight brothers and sisters, their spouses, my mom and dad, you know, and then outside the bloodline became the New York City Fire Department family, my triathlete family. You know, they didn't let me quit. And they took care of me for a very long time that made me get this done.
Yeah, I mean, people outside of New York should realize this was, this was headline news. I think you had the whole dynamic of, first of all, firemen after 9/11 and the strong feelings everyone in New York had then and do now for the firemen. But you had Mayor Bloomberg was there, the governor was there visiting you. I mean, this was headline story for weeks.
Yes, it was. And I was very lucky. I tell you what, it got better than that. And unfortunately, I lost a lot of my memorabilia in the Hurricane Sandy fire. Which was after the book was written. But I even got a letter from the President of the United States.
Wow.
So it was widely publicized, but I got a letter from on his personal stationery saying that him and Laura were praying for me, and I was given a papal blessing, which is also very hard to get. So I had some really good stuff, and like you said, the core group of my network, my team, my family, the little fingers spread out and touched so many people that I got a lot of help.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's great. And I think I mentioned this to you in an email. I love the conversation you had with your parents. And this, I guess, is when you were really at, I guess, near your lowest point, as far as emotionally. I mean, physically, you were on the mend. But can you share with us what how that conversation went and how your mother reacted to what you said? I love that.
Yeah, oh, no, what I'm saying, it was definitely my emotional and mental low point. Physically, mm-hmm. I was still not on the mend yet. I was not, I was still awaiting the outcome of surgeries. And
yeah, but
so
you
I
were
went
home
to a,
from the hospital at this point.
I was
right?
home. I was home from the hospital, yeah. But I wasn't progressing yet. I was still
okay.
being pushed around in a wheelchair and,
okay.
and stuck, for lack of better words, I was stuck in that why me period of the accident.
Yeah. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I was hoping for this doctor's appointment to turn me around. And the doctor,
mm-hmm.
it just didn't, the news I got didn't do that. So I had told my parents and, let me just give a little background. My dad is a former Marine,
mm-hmm.
nicknames like Iron Mike and the Duke. So he's a pretty
yeah,
tough
okay.
man.
Yeah.
And my mom is a mother of nine, so that states for itself how tough she is.
That's right.
So I had just reached across the table at lunch after this doctor's appointment, and I started to cry and said to them, I'm glad that you guys prayed and got what you wanted. And I personally really wished you had prayed for me to die. And I quickly realized that that's something you never want to say to your mom.
Oh, that'll piss a mother off, huh?
Yeah.
Especially an Irish
mother. My dad started to weep, and my mother put her hands down on the table, and she just said, if you want to be a miserable SOB the rest of your life, go ahead and do it by yourself. She goes,
mm-hmm.
We didn't get hit by this bus, but we've been with you every step of the way, every dinner, every surgery, every recovery time you woke up from anesthesia, we've been
mm-hmm.
with you. So
mm-hmm.
we didn't let you quit, and if you want to quit, do it on your own. We're out.
Yeah.
And
wow.
That was tough. That was what I call good
yeah.
old-fashioned tough love. Tough
yeah,
love.
That is. That is.
But at the very end of that, she told me, Matthew, she goes, you're not the only person in this world that is suffering right now. And
uh-huh.
between that hard, tough love kind of do-it-by-yourself thing and her opened my eyes to the fact that, you know what, she's right.
Yeah.
You know, there are other people that are suffering worse than I am.
Yeah.
And I needed to snap out of it. So she really,
mm-hmm.
I kind of equated to growing up in your old stove. You have that pilot light that burns in the middle of the stove, and you just got to
yep,
turn the
yep.
knobs to get the burners going. Well, my mother turned
yeah.
on all my knobs. My burners were going,
yep.
and my attitude
yep.
changed, and everything started getting better from there.
That's great. So you were home. You were still, had, many more operations. How many total operations did you have?
43
even now?
Procedures. Yeah, 43.
Yeah.
43
wow.
in about 15 months.
Oh, my.
You
were,
last
in,
one,
you were in the hospital for like 5 months, right?
I was in the hospital for
five months.
Had about 17 to 18 procedures while I was in the hospital and went back for the rest after.
Yeah, yeah.
The last surgery lasted 13 hours.
Wow. Yeah, I remember, a couple of things that you said that were really striking. I remember you finally, you went to a rehab facility in Arizona, right?
Yes.
How did that come about? Because that's a big turning point, I'm sure. You agree.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was a big turning point. I needed to get out of the city. And a funny story, it's odd that I can find humor in some of the things that happened to me, but that, I think it's
yeah.
part of my personality.
Yeah.
And laughter is a big cure for a lot of things. So
mm-hmm.
I, a funny part of my story is I was now walking with two Canadian crutches, and I would get up every morning, and before therapy I would kind of walk out of my apartment and go to Starbucks and get a coffee. And
mm-hmm.
there was always the same a homeless guy outside Starbucks, just kind of panhandling a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I called him Big Man. I always said hello to him. I said, hey, Big Man, how you doing? And one day,
mm-hmm.
he says to me, hey, my man, you're that fireman that got run over by the bus, aren't you? I was like, oh my goodness. I was like, even the homeless guy knows who I am and what's going on with me. So I said, I needed to get out of New York for a little while. So I decided that I needed to leave the city for a little while. I needed to get to warm weather so that training or rehabilitation wouldn't be inhibited by the weather or distraction. And I emailed a couple of places on the West Coast. I emailed some places in Florida. And I was getting typical responses like, you know, when I sent them an email, I would send them links to all the stories and what happened to me. And I would get responses from people saying, well, you know, we'll gladly try to help you, but you should have realistic expectations because my end request was I want to run again.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you help me? And they would say you should have realistic expectations. And once I read that,
Don't you hate hearing that? Don't you hate hearing that?
Mm-hmm. I hate 100%. That, so. I mean,
yep.
I just kept deleting it. And finally, a therapist and a strength coach that worked in a place in Arizona, in Tempe, the place is now called Triplex Training, and they both responded to my email, we would never tell anyone they couldn't run again.
Wow.
And I moved out there 2 weeks later, sight unseen. I didn't know what the place looked like. I didn't know what the two guys looked like. I said, I'm coming out to look for an apartment. I came out. I got an apartment to rent. And that's when things really started turning around physically for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, the training was, I mean, this was, I would assume the answer is yes, but I'm thinking that your rehab training was probably a lot more difficult than you, you know, toughen your way through a marathon.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I had to go back to zero pretty much. I had to teach myself how to walk again. You know, I had to teach myself, look, I have permanent disabilities, so I had to teach. And that's one of the things I've learned, John, the body wants to be healthy. And if you have an injury, if you have something going on, the muscles around the injured muscles say, hey, we got it. We'll help you get through this. So I have permanent disabilities. I have muscles that never came back. I had severed nerves. So, but I can do things that doctors said, oh, I bet you can't do any push-ups because your shoulder's all messed up, and I would get down on the floor and do 50 push-ups.
Yeah.
And they can't explain it because I can't put my right arm above my head.
Yeah.
But I could do what I need to do to get it done. So, yeah, the body really wants to be healthy. The body finds a way to do it. The mind finds a way to do it. And, I went through 6-day-a-week training in Arizona where that's all I did. I treated myself like a professional athlete. I did nothing but eat right and train.
I know that I love the part of the book, which is very inspiring, of you finishing your first mile out there in the training with the two trainers next to you.
Yep.
How long did that first mile take for you to finish?
I think I ran my first mile in 21 minutes. I was basically doing all this stuff with these guys, and I said to them one day, I said, "Well, hey, how are we going to figure out if this is working? When do I become a runner again?"
Yeah.
And so we looked at the calendar, and he said, "When are you leaving?" And I said, "Well, I moved out here in January. I'm leaving mid-April." And they said, "Well, a week before you leave, we're going to go out and run. Let's just keep working."
Wow.
So I just did all the training they told me to do, and a week before I left, we went out on the canals of the Tempe Town Lake, and they said, "Let's go for a mile." I said, "Okay."
Wow.
So we walked a mile out and trotted coming home, and it took about 21 minutes. It was painful, but at the same time, it was a huge breakthrough for me. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll bet. Now, is that when you decided that you're going to run another marathon? Or did that come after?
No, I knew that if I can get it done, that I had to do another marathon. So I didn't verbalize it to anyone. I didn't express interest to anyone. I don't think the therapist would have been too excited if that's what I told them my goal was. Because it made their job harder to not take away my hope. But yeah. As soon as I finished that mile, I told those two guys, I said, I'm going home next week and I'm signing up for the New York City Marathon.
Wow,
and the one therapist
awesome.
Said, if you run it, I'll be there.
Okay.
And the other therapist said, I can't be there this year, but if you ever make a comeback to Ironman, I'll do it with you. And he's never done an Ironman.
Wow.
So when
today
I finish
you
my
are
marathon,
now, you're inspiring the guys who are training you and getting you back into shape, huh?
Yep.
Yeah, that's that C word, right?
The C word, 100%.
Yep. Okay, we're gonna take a halftime commercial break here, but then we'll be right back. And I want to hear about the people want to hear about you running the marathon and getting all that done. So we'll be back in just a couple minutes after this commercial break.
With video games, I'm often choosing between what my kids want and what I think is best for them.
Hey, Mom, how about this one?
Rated T for teen with violence and suggestive themes. Let me check the rating summary. Frenetic combat, cries of pain, female warlords exposed cleavage.
Maybe the other one's better.
The rating summaries are free. Use them, and you'll be armed with the world's most powerful weapon, knowledge.
For more information, go to ESRB.org.
Millions of people reuse their shopping bags every day, and Whole Foods Market makes it easier by offering a better bag in two different sizes. Find out more ways to make a green change at WholeFoodsMarket.com. That's WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back to Don't Give Up Your Daydream. This is John Knuckle. We're talking to Matt Long. Okay, Matt, now let's talk about the road back. Before we talk about the road back, I don't think we described enough the level of competition and the level of an athlete you were before this accident. I mean, you had qualified for the Boston Marathon because of your time in the New York Marathon, which is pretty tough to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's scaled. It's a scaled qualifying time across age groups. And at that point, 35 to 39-year-old male had to run a sub 315. At that point, I've only run a 348. So, I had to take off 30 minutes, 33 minutes to be exact.
That's
so
a lot.
So I shot out. Yeah, I trained really hard. I wound up doing an 11-hour Ironman. And just 4 months before that marathon, and I trained hard, paced myself out for a 3:10, and I put 5 minutes in the bank, figured to spare in case anything happened.
Yeah.
And I used 3 minutes of that, so I wound up finishing at 3:13.
Wow. And now, so you're ready for the Boston. Now, your Ironman experience before the accident, did you? I know there was one at Lake Placid. Were there any others, or was that it?
That was my first Ironman. In July of 2005, I did the Ironman Lake Placid for the first time.
Wow. So you're coming off like being at really, you're sort of reaching your peak before this, not that your peak can ever be reached, but, you're at a pretty high level before this accident happened.
Yeah, I'm pretty I'm better shape than I was in college when I was playing college basketball. I'm more focused because I'm more mature. I was doing everything right. You know, don't get me wrong, I was still a New York City fireman and I was still having fun living in Manhattan. But I was more disciplined, and I learned a lot of lessons training for marathon and Ironman about how to train properly. And make sure that every mile and every step counted rather than just, hacking through the motions.
Yeah, yeah. And your nutrition and everything must have been really like at a top level.
Yeah, I mean, yes, everything was as, I'd like to say, everything was as dialed in as it could be. And you know what? I may have been peak fit, but I didn't run my fastest race. If that bus never happened, my goal was to go sub three in Boston.
Yeah, I have no doubt you would have. I mean, at the level, I mean, just what gets me is it's a certain type of mentality that, you know, there was a transit strike and it was snowing, I believe, and you ride your bike to work. I mean,
it was like eight below.
Just, yeah,
with
I mean,
the windshield factor,
totally
it was eight
different.
Below.
Wow. Wow. That's just that is an athlete's kind of attitude, you know? It really is, which is great to have. So the road back now. I mean, what? How? I think, like, one leg is shorter than the other now. Is that right? Because of all the problem with the accident?
Mm-hmm. My hip is actually, from my pelvis being fractured, was set about three-quarters to an inch higher. So where the legs are the same length, it just the foot doesn't hit the same ground at the same level. So I have to have an inch of foam or rubber added to every shoe, running sneaker.
Yeah. I'm going to ask the question everyone's thinking: how the hell do you run a marathon? Tell me. How does it work? How do you have to progress slowly? It really is. It's almost hard to fathom for a regular guy like me. You know.
Well, you know, my gait now is very awkward, and it was something I needed to do for mental healing, for myself to know. Like, that was my one point in time in my life where I really had to be selfish and say, I need to get this done for me, no matter what happens.
Yeah.
And but to be out there for, you know, I went from 3:13 to 7 hours and 21 minutes. So to be out there for 7 hours and 21 minutes is a long, long day.
Yes.
And I was in a lot of pain afterwards, and I knew that I knew when I finished, I had another goal in mind, which was to become an Ironman again. And I knew that I wouldn't be able to do too much running and have a healthy body. So I had to work around that.
Yeah. One thing I thought was very interesting, which I never would have thought of, some of the people that ran with you on a first marathon back, they had a hard time because they were running a lot more steps and they were out there a lot longer than they were used to being out there.
Yeah, 100%. Listen, the great Greta Weitz ran a marathon with Fred LeBeau when he was sick before he passed.
Mm-hmm.
And it took him 5 or 6 hours. I don't know the exact time, but between 5 and 6 hours. Now, we're talking about a woman who would run a 2:11, you know, 2:15.
Yeah. Wow.
She said it was the hardest marathon she's ever run.
Wow.
It takes a lot of energy to run slow.
Yeah.
And my two friends, the two guys that ran the entire marathon with me, were sub-3-hour marathon runners, and they were there for 7:21.
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know, they were getting, but I was training at that pace, and I kept telling them, you guys got to go out and train with me a little bit. This is going to hurt.
Yeah.
And it hurt them quite a bit. I mean, I was going through a world of pain too, but, it hurt them quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember it was very stirring. The end of you coming up to the end of the line, to finish the marathon, get to the finish line. And I think it was your left foot that was really a problem. Your toes were bleeding.
Yep, my left foot is the leg that I broke, every bone in my left leg. And my left foot, the tendons kind of like went into they never released from a state of shock or whatever. So my toes are kind of like hammer toes now. And they were just destroyed from all those steps.
Yeah. And then what did you do when you finally finished? You talked about your push-ups, right? Or was that from the Ironman?
No, that was a marathon. I guess
great.
I saw all the fire department guys. I saw my family. Yeah. My doctors were there. And I started to well up a little emotionally, so I kind of I hit the floor to do some push-ups. Maybe that would stop me from crying, and it didn't work.
I like that. All right, so now you head off to the Ironman. Now you had to, you just mentioned about not being able to run a lot. Well, let me ask you, are you able to run a lot now, or is that something you have to really?
I haven't run a step since the Ironman.
Wow.
I just can't do
something.
It. Yeah.
It just illustrates what a struggle it was. That was, I mean, that you finished that. you can never run again. I mean, no.
I used all your bullets, huh?
100%.
I used everything. I had to do it for me. And if I run, I know now if I went out and ran 3 miles, it would take me 45 minutes, maybe an hour, and I'd be in bed for 3 to 4 days with back pain and hip pain. So now everything's done in a pool or on a bike.
Yeah. So you do a lot of biking, obviously.
Yeah.
How did it feel the first time getting up on a bike? Do you ever ride in the city?
Yeah, absolutely, yes, and I still do. The first time was very nerve-wracking. In fact, I couldn't do it. When I finally got a bike ordered for myself and picked it up from the bike shop, I forced myself to go from where I lived in the city. I took with all my bicycle and equipment and shoes and got in a cab, and so I would force myself to ride the bike home. And I took it out of the bike shop, and I couldn't get on it.
Wow.
And I called my friend, Noel Flynn, who ran the marathon with me, and he was at work. He's a CFO of a hedge fund, so he's, it's not like he doesn't have anything important to do. And I said, listen, Noel, I'm not in a good way. And he said, what's the matter? So I told him I got my bike. He's like, that's awesome, that's awesome. I said, yeah, but I can't get on it.
Yeah.
And he said, I'll be right there. He went home, got his bike, got his gear. Rode his bike to where I was, and we went for a lap together in Central Park, and that was my first experience back on the bike.
Well, yeah, I know. You know, it's funny how it's. I guess it's hard to put people to put themselves in your position, but just as an example, I was in the middle of your book. I was I'm in Midtown a lot. And I'm walking around, and I'm waiting at a curb, and I was going like, oh, geez, is that bus? Where's that bus? Is that bus turning? Look at that cab. Is that cab? You know, I'm getting nervous by the traffic in the town just from reading your book. So I can't imagine how it must have been for you. But I guess, you have to do these things, right? Or else what are you going to do? Stay in your room,
You have to get back out there and live your life. You have to.
Yeah.
You know, look, what happened to me can happen to anyone. We know it. And you just need to get back out there and engage in life. And because it could happen to you while you're sitting down doing nothing. So, you might as well live it and love it rather than live full of regret.
I agree. That's great. Can we talk a little bit about the Lake Placid Ironman? After the injury, because this was, this really had me in tears just reading it. So if you could tell a little bit about how difficult that was and what it meant to you.
First of all, it was, I always had the same an attitude before my accident and after. When a race was about to start, I asked myself one question. I said, is my training going to let me down? I trained super hard on the bike, super hard in the pool, but I wasn't able to run very much for this Ironman training. So all I would do 1 or 2 miles out in the park or out in the streets just to feel the pounding of the road. Or an ARC trainer in the gym, something that simulated running, so I would have no impact. The start of that Ironman, I had no idea if today was the day my training would let me down or not. Most of the times I had that confidence that, I put all the hard work in. But the start of that comeback Ironman, I had no idea. And it's 140. I don't know what Ironman is. It's 140.6 mile race, 2.4 in the water, 112 on a bike, and a marathon. And 17 hours to finish.
Wow.
If you do not make it at 17 hours, that's it. It's over. You got nothing. So, I really wanted to get this done. I wanted to be called an Ironman again so that then I could figure out what would be next for me. And, I got lucky. I finished that Ironman. I mean, the hardest part for the race, I was very disappointed in my swim. I thought I improved, if anything, after my accident, and that didn't come up to be the case. I was about 10 minutes slower than I was prior.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bike ride, was it? And my run was about 8. I just made it 16 hours, 58 minutes, and 6 seconds.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, I remember from reading the swim was really, that's what gave you a problem when you first started doing these endurance tests.
What was that, John?
The swim was one of the difficult things for you when
yes.
you first started doing mm-hmm. these endurance sports.
Yes, you know, look, I grew up in Brooklyn and spent summers in Breezy Point, Queens, and
uh-huh.
on the ocean, and I always thought I knew how to swim. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
here I am in my 30s trying to do triathlons, and I realized that I've never swam a lap in a pool.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Being hanging around the ocean or taking in waves is big difference than knowing how to swim.
Mm-hmm.
And
it
was hard for me to learn that. Yep.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the I Will Foundation. I think it's such a great thing, and I've been on the website quite a bit, and the people you have on it are amazing. The things you do is great. But where did the idea come from, the concept of I Will?
Well, it was right around the time my mom gave me that smack of tough love
mm-hmm.
where I started
mm-hmm.
to realize that if I keep waking up in the morning thinking of all the things I can't do, then that's how my day would end up, with nothing accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I researched a little bit on the internet, found someone who was hurt as bad or close to as bad as I was, and I reached out to him for help. And he agreed to help me, I said to him, you know, you help me, I'll help others, I promise.
Mm-hmm.
And that became a mission in life to, hey, let someone else know that if you're in the shape that I'm in, that good things can come from it, not to give up. And
mm-hmm.
I just put those two words together and formed the foundation
mm-hmm.
so that I
mm-hmm.
could put it as out there in the internet, in the world, for anyone to see. And and little by little, you know, people started checking it out. And now, I to this point, I still get people emailing me saying thank you, or they say, how can I help? And they
uh-huh.
they
uh-huh.
send me donations so I can help people.
Yeah, yeah. I love the idea of it's not I want to or I'm going to or I promise to. It's just I will.
And that's it. And never two more powerful words can
mm-hmm.
be said if you're looking to get something accomplished. You know, when I travel the country now, giving some motivational talks, I like to tell them, I say, you know, the bosses don't like this part of it, but I say, look, if you wake up and the first two words out of your mouth or the first two words that enter your mind are, I can't, I said, then hit the alarm and go back to sleep, because you're going to be useless
mm-hmm.
to your team, you're going to be useless to your job, you're going to be useless to you. You know, if you wake mm-hmm. up every morning and say, look, I know I have a hard day in front of me, but I will get it done.
Yeah.
You know, you're gonna have progress.
Yeah. This brings up a question. This something that I don't know if anybody asked you this, or if it's something you've come across, or you know the way to deal with this. But I would think that a lot of people, if they read your book or know your story, that they might be in a way a little intimidated by it. In that, you know, most people, their obstacles in life are they're downsizing at work or you know, relationship problems or things like that. And your struggle was so, like, epic that is there something you would tell people that would help them, you know, through your story to realize their obstacles and find a way through them?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, John, what I like to tell people is this. A lot of people introduce me or look at my story and say, wow, look at the adversity this man overcame.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to stop them when they say that and say, look, I didn't overcome any adversity. I learned to live with it. I learned
mm-hmm.
to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
So what I tell people now is, look, whether it's a physical challenge, a mental challenge, or just some obstacle that's getting in your way, keeping you from where you want to be, don't fight it. Accept
mm-hmm.
it. Take ownership of it and go right through it. And
mm-hmm.
that's the way you're going to see success. That's the way you're going to achieve your goals. You know, okay, so I really could still be in a wheelchair, and no one would have a problem with that. I was run over by a bus.
Yeah.
And everyone would still, you know, have some kind of empathy for me or feel sorry for me or whatever, but no one would be upset if I was still in a wheelchair. But my mom gave me that smack. I took ownership of what happened to me. I accepted the fact that I'm never going to run a three-hour marathon again.
Mm-hmm.
And I found other ways to fuel my passion with cycling, with swimming, with weight training. You know, I'm going to be 50.
Wow.
And I'm in better shape now than I was before my accident with outside the fact that I can't run.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, so you're biking. I mean, you could bike as well as you did when you finished that first triathlon, the first Ironman?
I bike as well and as strong, just not as fast. Okay?
I
do a lot of things better than I couldn't do before with what I have today. I accepted the body that I have. So my right side, there's paralyzations in my glutes, my stabilizer muscles, my abductors and adductors. So there's things I can't do. And when I'm on a bike and the road starts to go uphill, when the glutes are supposed to take over, I'm basically pedaling with one side of my body. And I'm getting it done. It's tough. It's right. It's tough. It makes it harder. Yeah. It's a little demoralizing when people that you look at and like, wow, I'm a lot fitter than this person. I should be moving ahead faster. But you know what? I accept it, and I don't mind it. I don't mind if it's a girl passing me or someone who just looks, an individual that looks less fit than me. It's okay with me. You know?
Yeah.
I'm okay with it. I'm doing the best I can do.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you're doing a hell of a lot better than most 50-year-olds who've never had an accident in their lives, right?
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, all right, I want to talk a little more about the I Will Foundation. I love the idea that you have the ambassadors and the exemplifiers and some of these people that are on your site. I mean, their stories are amazing also. There's Hector.
Yeah, Hector
Picard
from Florida.
I mean, these people are great.
You know, what happened was, so the ambassadors of the foundation were basically people that helped or inspired me. And I asked them, you know, there's from one of my nurses, Nurse Vicky, to Tara Norton from Canada. She's a professional triathlete who inspired me, to my old triathlon coach, Anthony Carrillo. So I basically asked them, I said, look, you guys were part of my team before the accident and during my recovery. So I would like you to be part of this foundation and possibly help others. And they all said yes. They all didn't even hesitate. And I didn't really go on an active search looking for people that needed the help. I waited for it to come to me. And I'll tell you how I found Hector Picard. We'll talk about Hector. Hector is a double-arm amputee. He was electrocuted about 15 years ago. Both arms, one at the shoulder, one at the elbow, blown off his body. And I went down to Florida for a training trip, and I was in the bike shop, and one of the guys saw my story on HBO, and he's like, oh my, you know, he couldn't believe it was me. He's like, I can't believe this. I saw your story. It's unbelievable. You have to meet this guy that comes in here, Hector Picard. He needs help. And I said, well, what does he need help with? He said, he needs a bike. We've been trying to work with him and build him a bike, but we need someone better to build him a bike. So I said, I'll meet him tomorrow. I had no idea what was wrong. Didn't ask. I go to the bike shop after my ride the next day, and Hector's there. No arms.
Wow.
I'm like, how is this guy going to ride a bike? And for whatever reason, I didn't think that he couldn't do it. I questioned it. How is he going to do it? But I didn't think that he couldn't. And I wound up calling the guy in New York City who built my bike, and I told him about it. And Paul Levine from Signature Cycles, one of the best bike fitters in the country, he built him a bike, and it's just amazing. And this guy does Ironman now.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
I mean, how does he get the swim portion done?
He does a breaststroke kick on his back.
Wow.
Yep, for 2.4 miles.
I mean, I would urge anyone who's listening to go on the I Will Foundation site. I mean, some of these stories are really, really, I mean, it's inspiring. Now, to some brighter topics, you know, not everything's a struggle. I do my research after reading your book. You got married in 2011, right?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah, I got married in 2011 to a great girl, an athlete herself. And she had two children prior, and we have our own little girl named Charlie.
Wow.
That's
so three girls?
Yeah, three girls.
You're in a house
surrounded by
girls,
John. And if you read my book, I was always trying to be surrounded by girls, and now I'm surrounded by girls.
Well, now you got what you hoped for. Now, I will tell you from my experience, there were struggles ahead being in a house full of girls.
Thanks, John.
Right? There's going to be dating and cars and college.
One is 13. One of the girls is 13, so we're just hitting those trouble days now.
Yeah. The eye rolling. A lot of eye rolling goes on.
A lot of eye rolling, yes.
Yeah. Tell people where you can be reached, how they can help with the I Will Foundation, or if they need help, how they can contact. And, because the things you're doing, the people that are on here are really great. And your book, I mean, The Long Run. Everyone listening, just go buy this book today. But tell people where they can reach you and all of that.
Okay. Well, The Long Run is still on Amazon, and it's been out for a while, so it's now a good buy. I think it's $10 or $11 on Amazon. And the I Will Foundation, my contact is matt@iwillfoundation.com. It's iwillfoundation.com is the website. And like you said, you can go through the site and look at the ambassadors and look at the exemplifiers, and those are the people that I've helped that demonstrate the attitude and the will to succeed no matter what's in their way. You go on there, there's a button to click support, and you can help. If you know someone who needs help, or I wish I could help everyone and I can't, but I haven't had to say no too many times, thank goodness, because there's a lot of good people out there that send me $10 or $100, and so whatever it is they can do, that's great. Personally, I have another website called mattlongspeaker.com, and I book my speaking events through there. My accident, John, quite frankly, the way I like to sum things up, I lived a great life before, but now I live a life with purpose. And, I'm a symbol to many, many people, like my mom said, of someone who would inspire people not to give up. And
that's
then
great.
I'm pretty happy with that fact. In fact, I'm so happy with that if you ask me if I can go back in time and have the bus miss me, I would have to say no.
Wow. That's an incredible statement. And also people can see, if they go on the Matt Long speaker site, there's a video clip of you doing one of your presentations. It's very inspiring. Okay,
that's
Matt,
my TEDx.
We have to go.
I wish
that I could have dinner with you at Smith and Wolensky's one of these nights. If anyone reads
someday
the book,
can happen,
know
John.
What
we can make
about.
That work.
Okay, me, you, Jack Ryan. What do you think? We'll get together.
I love it.
Yeah, okay. All right, thank you so much, Matt. I'm going to end with my closing words. So I was standing on the corner of Broadway and Rector Street when the South Tower of the World Trade Center came down. I was two blocks away, yet I never actually saw it. My back was turned when I heard the roar of the building imploding. To me, it sounded like a third plane, and from the sound of it, I thought it was right on top of me. So I ran like hell and murmured, oh my God, over and over to myself. I looked back once, expecting to see the nose of a plane emerge from the black avalanche that was chasing me down Broadway. What I saw was a wave of dust and cement and debris. A piece of metal flew past my head, turning end over end, and a computer keyboard landed on the ground next to me. Just then, I saw something remarkable. A man in uniform running into it, running into hell. Now, I managed to get myself home, and over time, I got back to my normal routine. My job required me to drive into the city twice a week. I had a hard time with it. I rarely slept the night before, and on the way down the West Side Highway of Manhattan, I kept going over escape plans in my head. What if they blow up the George Washington Bridge? Why is that unmarked van driving so close to me? It was starting to become debilitating, so I went to see someone. I told him about my anxious drives, and he asked me if I kept going. Do I make my appointments? Yes, of course I do, I replied. He gave me some common sense advice. What I was feeling was normal, and it would lessen in time. Being a professional, he knew there was more, so he pressed me a bit. I finally came out with it. How dare I? I watched a man run into hell to save others. Let's face it, he probably didn't make it, since the North Tower collapsed next, and he must have been right there. So I watched a man sacrifice his life to help others, and I'm a wreck after just running away. How dare I? The doctor's response turned around my way of thinking and steered me towards the road to recovery. You can help how you feel, he said. Someone who watched it on TV may be more affected than you. There are people all over the world who may be more upset than you, even though you were right there. Accept that you feel this way and deal with it. I learned that any obstacle, great or small, is real. The things that are holding us back should never dismiss or minimalize or be minimalized. They should be recognized, then dealt with appropriately. You can't help how you feel. That's a fact. You also can't give up on your daydream, because that's a cure. Please see us at don'tgiveupyourdaydream.webs.com and visit me at johnknuckle.com. And I have some news. My new short story, The Victory Grill, will be available on Amazon.com and on Kindle Friday, March 18th. It's a nice little New York story about transition, which is what we talk about here. Anyway, thank you all for being here. Thank you, Matt Long. It was a privilege, and everyone be well.